Let's then embark on the final track of this whole series. Now, if you'd like to do that by going back all the way to the beginning of the series, when I gave you a little computer demo of what such n-body systems do, when you actually do the computations in a computer rather than analytically. Of course, doing things analytically has served to increase our understanding of the whole system rather than having to do the same type of numerical experiment over and over and over again. We get some overall idea as to what the typical fate of stellar systems is, which is summarized in the sequence I have over there. First you have a core bounce, then you have a modest relaxation process, and finally you have core collapse followed by gravithermal oscillations. I'm going to demonstrate this with my old workhorse, the Plummer model. And I will do this as follows. I'll just first show you a actual live run of such a system. And then after that, I will do a few steps, just a few, showing you what the kind of analysis is one can exert on these kind of systems, which is rather similar to what one would do at a telescope. So in a sense, one's computer is a numerical observatory, and I will try to show you at least some of the steps of what you can do with such numerical n-body systems. I will set up the whole system as a Plummer sphere of, well, shall we take 800 bodies to begin with, then it runs more or less smoothly. And I start with initial velocities that correspond to exactly the virial speed in a system like this. Of course, you have the liberty in a code like this to start below or above the virial velocity, but let me take it exactly equal to the virial speed here. The radius of the system is immaterial. You simply use it as a length unit, and I use a leapfrog method to integrate things with. I will give a relatively slow way of making things move on the screen, because that will give me the opportunity to point out various phenomena as they occur. The system allows me, I've programmed things in such a way that you can pick out one star of which you actually follow the orbit. So whereas all the other stars are refreshed on the screen all the time, so you get a dynamical motion in your system, there is one star that, as it were, like a snail, leaves a trail behind, and that is under some circumstances useful. All right then, let us do this, and we can start with a system like this. So this is your typical initial condition. As you can see, several things that I mentioned in the past are important. Oh, by the way, this is the star that we're going to follow the trail of later on. On the average, it is spherically symmetric, which is quite obvious in a plot like this. But when you look in detail at the small-scale distribution here, you do see Poisson noise. Right? So, for instance, the two stars that you find over here, these two, are close together in space purely by accident. Right? And that means that the dynamics locally over here is going to be dominated on the short time scale by the interaction between these two particles. Right? And that is still, this is pure chance. That illustrates what I said earlier. When we consider the motion of a star with respect to the average galaxy, this is something that we must not ignore. Right? So, whereas considering a system like this as smooth has its virtues, overall, this is in detail no longer not really justified. All right, so let us stop the whole thing and we start time running. The core bounce happens rather quickly, so I recommend this to your attention. It has, in fact, already started. You see the center of the cluster here contract. And if I were to stop time here for a moment, you can quite clearly see that the core has already started to contract. And this is, even though I have started the stars with a velocity that corresponds to the virial speed. Right, so you might say that, well, that ought to be in equilibrium, but in actuality it is not. If you sort of zoom in on this central system over here, you see that it's much more compact than the galaxy was to begin with. Zooming back out again, let us see in some more detail what this core collapse looked like. You see most of the stars here concentrated towards the center, and at this moment, they pass through the center here. It's a collisionless system. I mean, in a gaseous system, this would, of course, lead to a shock wave that propagates outward, whereas the center would then become hot and remain relaxed, and that is because in a gaseous system, the particles can physically collide. In this case, they cannot, so they shoot right through the center and go back out. And as you can see, when you follow the envelope over here, you can see that the whole system starts to expand again. Right? So your eye can already notice that the bounce wave has approximately come to this area over here, which is not very dissimilar from what it was before. If, however, you look at the system overall, you will see that it is more centrally concentrated than it was before. So this core bounce has definitely led to a slight increase of the density in the center of the system. Even so, the system itself is still spherically symmetric, as is perfectly clear from a simulation like this. Well then, turning time on again, we see that at this particular moment, the stars end up in some sort of equilibrium situation. That is rather similar to what I sketched on the blackboard over there. In this case, the core of the system is becoming more or less relaxed, and we have to wait until this core collapse sets in. If we take a page or two from the computations that I showed to you earlier from this figure in the book, you will notice that you would have to zoom in rather closely in order to see the stars that participate in this core collapse. It's only the central few percent or something thereabouts, which in this case is actually too small to be resolved. We started with 800 stars, so a few percent of that would be 20, 30 stars or something thereabouts. And zooming in, we see that that would be approximately this particular area of the whole system. If you were to follow the stars in the center over here, you would see that they do remain more or less in this general area. The quicker ones that you see crossing the field over here, like this one, for instance, over here, or that one, for instance, over there, are halo stars that zoom through the center with great velocity. Of course, the visitors over here, the visiting halo stars, such as this star of which we have followed the trajectory, this one over here, do go through the center and then change their energy. When we see what happens to this star over here, of which we follow the trail, you see that far out, it follows a section of orbit which is rather reminiscent of a Keplerian orbit, which stands to reason because at this great distance, it sees most of the mass of the cluster concentrated in the center. Having passed through the center over here, let me see if I can zoom in on this for a moment. Having passed close to the center here, you see that its speed has increased. And then going back out again, it comes to a radius which is rather bigger than the radius that it had before. If we were to wait a little moment, we would see that this distance from the radius where it started, so the apocenter distance, as it were, is a little bit smaller than the distance to which the star will increase here. So it has, in fact, gained energy by having passed through the center over here. So the mechanism that we discussed in the beginning of the first lecture today, we see in front of our eyes over here, we stop the time for a moment, we see that the apocenter distance from there to there is rather bigger than the apocenter distance from there to there. Right? So we can definitely see that this star has gained energy by passing through the center of this cluster. There are many stars in the periphery over here that are on their way to infinity. The code follows them faithfully, so just simply just a few of them. But effectively, if you were to look at the details, you will see that from this radius onward, which is something of the order of 15 times the core radius, many of the stars, in fact most of the stars, are gravitationally unbound. Continuing the time run, at this moment, the core collapse has started. You can see already that there is a slightly denser area developing over here. But as I mentioned a moment ago, this is not properly resolved by this little demo because we have restricted ourselves to only 800 stars, which simply is not enough in order to properly follow what is happening in the center over here. But you get some indication from the central concentration that you see over here. The halo star is again on its way to the center, and by looking at its orbit, you can already see what I mentioned a moment ago. Halo orbits have very, very large eccentricities. If you were to go even further out than this particular star that we're following over here, you will see that most of the stars are on practically radial orbits. And therefore, just by following this simple single star here, you can already get an indication of what the dispersion of the stars is going to be like at great distances. I already mentioned that in the center, the velocity distribution is isotropic. If you were to go close in over here, you will see that this is purely isotropic in space, and it is isotropic in velocity. But in the case of such a system star coming in from the halo, this is no longer the case. It is passing through the core over here. You'll see it speed up. And the question one has to ask oneself is, has this star gained or lost energy by this particular process? Now, as you can see from here, the apocenter distance that it had previously is bigger than the apocenter distance to which it is going now. So this particular passage has cost the star energy rather than it gained. And there again, this is something that we had seen analytically before. It is a probability process. Not every time you play in the lotto do you win, right? So it's only after a large number of times passing by that you stand a small chance of actually winning again and again and again, and then ending up in the unbound region, such as some of these stars over here on the periphery. Now, when seeing something like this, one can see in front of one's eyes what the connection is with the potential plot that we had seen a moment ago. Now let us see if we can do that, including the system over here. When you have a stellar system of this sort, we had seen that the potential generically takes this sort of shape. And you know from the Virial theorem that the distribution of the velocities then is going to look something like this, and that would be the V squared distribution for stars that have a V at infinity equal to zero. Okay, they're just marginally bound. You know from energy conservation what is going on with the velocities of the stars close to the center. It has the same kind of shape, except a little bit lower. Which means, because this is V squared, that such stars do not venture beyond these turning points over here. And if you were to take the square root, you could just simply see what the velocity distribution is like. Your typical velocity distribution would be a sort of clover leaf like this. Considering then what that means for the interaction between such a swirling star and the rest going on over here, we can easily see that from this diagram. Such a star, when it gets close to the center, would be, for instance, at this particular radius. All right, so shall we say that this is the radius at which that star now has arrived. Dynamically speaking, then, what is going on is that this star is coming in with a velocity that is bigger than the velocities of the stars that it encounters. And it is this difference that it can exploit in order to change its state of motion. Right? Now, by and large, a star coming in from the halo will have an inward speed at this particular point. Right? So if I were to have to draw radius versus potential, if I were to draw the direction of the velocity of a star over here, it would typically be a halo star, be going inward. However, the stars that it encounters can go either way, right? Because they're just simply bound to the core over here. So a star that it encounters here could go like this, or it could go like that. Which means that if, again, you transform to the center of mass system of these two stars, that means that if this halo star encounters a core star that is going the same direction, then in the center of mass system, their relative speeds are smaller. That means that the interaction is different from what you have in the opposite case, because then the relative speed of these two stars is rather bigger than it was before. Now, you might say, well, that's cool, because that means that when you move in the same direction of the star, the interaction is going to be all that much stronger, right? Because the total contribution of the velocity to the energy is small, and the attraction between the two stars is still going to be the same. So the scattering is going to be big. That's true on the one hand. On the other hand, if you move with respect to stars that are going counter to yourself, then, yes, an individual interaction will not be as severe as when you move approximately at the same speed in the same direction. That's true. On the other hand, you know perfectly well from driving on the freeway that when you go counter to traffic, you encounter more cars than when you go with the traffic. And therefore, the encounter rate is going to be bigger in that case. And there's a subtle balance between these two as to who is going to win. Right, so you can already see from a simple scalar case here that doing your sums properly and ending up at the equations that we had in the book for the relaxation rates and so on and so forth could be relatively complicated. To conclude then, let us see if we can get some idea as to what these numbers do when you analyze them. And that is the final step that I wanted to take. In the computer code that I have written here, the user can press S, the S key, in which case you make a snapshot, that's why it's called S, of the whole system over here. And let us see what we can get out of that. Such a snapshot contains a long list of numbers, which is the positions and the velocities of the stars, the masses of the stars, and their radius and their radial velocity. Of course, you can do any amount of analysis on this, right? You have a complete overview of your entire stellar system. So let us see if we can actually do that. You can take any plotter that you please, and I have already prepared ahead of time two snapshots that might be interesting. This is a similar run to the one that I've demonstrated to you a moment ago. The vertical direction shows the radial velocity, and the horizontal direction shows the radius. Now, the shape of this curve is something that obviously we recognize. I already mentioned to you a moment ago that the core of such a system is parabolic in potential. And I demonstrated that in such a parabolic potential, the velocity is proportional to the radius. In other words, you have solid body rotation. And that is exactly what we see here. The velocity goes up, the radius goes like this, and by and large, we have a straight line in the core of solid body rotation. On the periphery, however, we have Kepler's third law, and that means that you have an envelope which has this famous two-thirds power over here on this particular side. It's exactly what you see. All right. Now, having started the system in an ideal state like this, this is what you get after approximately 20 crossing times. Notice, by the way, that the horizontal scale in this case is the same, so the same this one and that one, but the vertical scale after about 20 crossing times goes from 0 to 2 and runs from 0 to 0.4 in the initial state. In other words, we have seen that since the velocity here is very much bigger, not only is it very difficult to discern this solid body rotation any further, although we do see this Keplerian envelope still over here. At the same time, however, there are some particles, as you can see here, that have in fact escaped. They're way above the Keplerian speed. This one and that one and that one have definitely escaped. And the temperature in the center is very much bigger. The random motions of the stars are very much bigger than what we started with. Right? So this concentration that we had seen occurring in the first few timescales has already increased the central random motion of the stars very, very drastically. Let us see now, to conclude, how one would do this in practice. If one starts with the output of such an n-body system, You just simply get it in. All right. So the final thing that I showed you on the demonstration just a moment ago is the one that I'm going to read in now. And then you can make a plot of whatever it is you please. Like in this particular case, I'm going to make a scatter plot of the radius against the radial velocity. And this is what you get. So this is basically the same thing that I showed you in this other diagram before, except that this now refers to what you have seen happen in front of your eyes. This is the radial velocities and the positions of the run that I just showed you. Of course, you can zoom in on the center, which might be a useful thing to do. So let us see what we can do there. All right. Okay. So this is the core of this particular system. You have to really look with the eye of faith to see that in the core you have something that has an edge over here that corresponds to the solid body rotation that I was mentioning earlier. You have the Keplerian envelope, of course, but for the rest there is zero structure. This is a totally thermal system in here. It is things like this that allow one to not only verify the analytic computations and calculations that I've showed to you earlier, but also to, guided by that analytic work, make a very much more detailed comparison with what is actually observed. Because the funny thing about it is that such a plot as I'm showing over here is a theoretical result, but since it relates directly to observables, all right, it should be something one can look at in practice. Of course, the radial velocity is not something that one can readily observe, but the velocity in another direction is. So, for instance, what I can do is the following. I can choose to plot, for instance, the coordinates in one direction, that would be, for instance, transverse in the sky, versus the velocity in another direction, that might be the radial velocity, in which case you get something like this. Now, watch this thing over there. I already mentioned to you that your typical velocity distribution would have this cloverleaf appearance. And this is exactly what we see in this case. Horizontally, we see the distance, plus or minus, in this particular spherical galaxy. And vertically, we see the radial velocity, also plus or minus, in a certain direction. Again, the envelope over here stays nicely inside the Keplerian envelope that we would expect. And here you can see the presence of this core, this hot core, very much more clearly. So, for instance, if I were to restrict myself to just a narrow area around the center over here, let us see if we can do that. Oops, I'm sorry, something wrong. Then you see that the core is really restricted to a very, very small section of the system altogether, right? There's a 0.1, 0.2 or something thereabouts contains most of the stars over here, whereas on this particular scale, the stellar system would be way off the screen. So, again, the lack of structure here shows that there's a completely thermalized system, and this is something that we can really readily look at with a telescope. Suppose that you were to have a telescope that could observe the radial velocity distribution of a galaxy as a function of a cross-section there, then this is exactly what you would expect to see. Now, the modeling then would correspond to trying to relate the point density here, the density of stars in this particular section of phase space, because that's what it is, to what is actually directly observed. This will be difficult, because what you directly observe is mostly not a star count, but a surface brightness, right? So there are certain interpretation steps in between there. But that is ultimately what we try to do. Once you have found that, then hopefully you will be a step closer to understanding what the structure and evolution of such a stellar system is. With all the limitations that we had seen so far, we do not include stellar dynamics, we do not include interaction with other galaxies because of the cosmological context. But even so, after having seen this, I think that he would realize that even for an initial simple stellar system like this, life is complicated enough. I thank you for your attention. I thank you for attending my lectures.